You're listening to Limelight, part of the We Love Where You Live podcast series brought to you by the Michigan Municipal League. Here's your host, Emily Kalishevsky.
Welcome to Limelight, a podcast that illuminates the work being done at the local government level, the stories behind the people that do it, and the topics that matter to them. I'm your host, Emily Kalishevsky. In August 2018, Michigan saw overwhelming success of hundreds of proposals on local ballots. Of the 847 local proposals Michigan residents voted on, 808, or 89%, were approved. This goes to show, in 2018, Michigan residents stepped up to invest in local services. But what makes or breaks a local ballot proposal? As more communities explore revenue-generating options, a successful proposal requires a significant groundwork, including smart messaging and voter engagement. Today's guest, Matt Resch, founded his communications, public relations, and issue management firm Resch Strategies 10 years ago, and is here to share his on-the-ground expertise. Listen on. All right. I am joined today by Matt Resch of Resch Strategies. So thank you for being with us today and coming on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. This is fun.
It is fun.
So love podcasts.
Me too. You have one. We'll get into that.
We do have a podcast, yes.
We'll get into that. But first, why don't you tell our listeners who you are and what it is that you do?
Well, Resch Strategies is the company that I founded. It was 10 years ago. So we're celebrating our 10th anniversary this year, which is exciting for us. I started my career in politics and public affairs and public relations out of college and working in Governor Engler's communications office. That was where I went after I graduated from college. And after doing a little bit in the constituent relations area, which I always thought is the best proving ground and training ground for working with the media, went into communications. And I was there until the end of the Engler administration. And was deputy communications director and press secretary when Governor Engler left office. I moved over to the legislature after that and worked for Speaker Rick Johnson and Speaker Craig DeRoche after that, while managing and directing the communications office for the Republican caucus. I went to another PR firm for a little bit after that, and after about a year and a half at that firm, started Resch Strategies. And so we are, you know, we're a public affairs firm, we're a public relations firm. You know, we're headquartered in downtown Lansing, so a lot of the work that we do is in support of trade associations, groups like MML, organizations that have a lot of business around the Capitol and state government. But we also have branched out over time and are doing both traditional PR for groups that have nothing to do with government, which is always kind of fun and refreshing, and, you know, branching into digital media, social media things as well. So it's been an evolving industry, and we've evolved along with it. And so we're 10 years in, and we're having a good time.
Excellent. Well, congratulations on
starting your own thing.
That's very exciting. 10 years is exciting, too. You know, it sounds like you have a wealth of experience and a wealth of knowledge. But one thing that we're here to talk about today, and we'll get into a lot of things, I think, but we're here today to talk about ballot proposals. Mm-hmm. So can you start us off with giving some examples of perhaps some ballot proposals that you've worked on in the past through some of either your group or before that?
Well, you know, our experience has been, you know, because we're based here in Lansing, we've had some experience here in town working mm-hmm. with both through my role with the Lansing Chamber of Commerce and the policy chair for the chamber. But also one of our clients is the Lansing School District. We just finished this last May a sinking fund election. And I worked with the school district on a couple of occasions, one kind of in a paid capacity this last spring on their sinking fund. But 3 years ago, in my role with the chamber, I was very involved on the other side as someone who the school district was coming to ask for support and help in the effort for their millage at that time as the policy chair. We've done a little bit of work with some other communities, and it was really more of an experience of how the kinds of groundwork you need to put into a campaign, because we were approached by a community. It wasn't actually the municipality. It was someone who was looking to build something in a municipality and needed voter approval. And, you know, one of the things I would always tell someone who was looking to pass or put something on the ballot is to look and put a premium on research. And so in that case, we did some polling in the community and found that what was being proposed was not popular. And the folks who were were backing it decided really before they got started that maybe this isn't the right time. And I think that's an important thing, whether you're looking, whether a municipality or local government looking to put something on the ballot, see what the lay of the land is on that. And it's an expensive thing, and I think it's something that's very valuable in getting prepared for a ballot proposal is doing the research up front.
So you talked about laying the groundwork. The research is one of them, or one of the things that municipalities might think about first when they're thinking about these things. But what else makes up that groundwork? So say a poll has occurred and maybe it's more positive than the last example that you provided. What are the next steps? What should communities be thinking about after they get some of that positive result back?
I think a critical part of a successful campaign is building a committee of people who are not local officials. You need to engage the community. You need to be very upfront about what you're wanting to do. In a lot of these cases, you're looking to raise tax revenue, right? So, and that's not typically a popular thing. I mean, there are some communities who will just do it, you know, whenever it's on the ballot. But in a lot of cases, you know, people are going to look at that pretty skeptically. So you want to build a coalition of people. And I look back again to my experience with the Lansing School District 3-4 years ago. They had come off a very unsuccessful attempt at raising a millage for the schools. It was unpopular, and it crashed and burned in a community, Lansing and Ingham County, that is pretty tax happy, to be honest. I mean, there are not many tax increases that the folks and that voters in Ingham County and Lansing haven't approved. But they defeated that one. And so they came back at the second bite at the apple and realized we can't do this as the district alone. We need to have some supporters. And so they built a committee of prominent business leaders who were supportive of the schools. They made an effort to reach out to community groups, business community, and to get a broad support and to be very upfront about what the money was going towards, how it was going to be spent, and how they were going to hold themselves accountable once the money was generated. That was a big concern. Speaking on behalf of the business community at the time, is that okay? If we raise this money for you and we help you, raise these taxes, how do we know that in 3 years or 5 years or 7 years, what you say you're going to spend it on is what you've actually spent it on, and how are you going to be good stewards of that? And so that coalition was critical, and they were able to lock down and get very supportive people in the room who had influence, who were able to raise money. These campaigns cost money. You obviously can't use city funds to pay for these things. So you're going to need to find outside money to do it. And people running city government, it's probably shouldn't be out there fundraising for campaigns either. And so having that coalition of people and that committee of people in place was very, very important. It was very important this last time with the Lansing Sinking Fund that we helped with. And I think that when cities or local governments try to go it alone and try to do these things without building some sort of support from the key voices in the community, it makes the job all that much harder.
Absolutely. So you mentioned engagement, community engagement, and obviously a piece of that is getting the key stakeholders in the room to assist with this sort of campaign. But how do you take it a step further from there? Once you've assembled those stakeholders, once you've got some support from those more prominent public figures who can help sort of move this forward, what are the next steps?
I think a couple of things. Messaging is critically important. You want to be able to describe and kind of describe for voters what it is that you're asking them to do. And I think in my experience, when you try to get too cute with that, voters are very skeptical. I think especially now, voters in this current climate are skeptical of pretty much everything, and probably rightfully so. And so you want to be upfront and not try to be too cute in your messaging, not try to be too coy and make it feel like you're trying to pull something over on people. I think you'd be very straight with the facts and very upfront. That messaging is very important. I think the other thing you need to do is you need to look at voting history. What neighborhoods in your community have been supportive of these kinds of things in the past? What neighborhoods have maybe been less supportive of this in the past? How have your absentee voters gone in these kinds of issues? Are they supportive of these things, or are they generally opposed to these kinds of things? obviously communities change, but looking at that voter history is very important. It allows you to know where your pockets of support are in a community. And if maybe you send two or three mail pieces to that neighborhood to make sure you really are getting those people out to vote when it comes time to vote. And maybe you don't send so many mail pieces to those neighborhoods that have been opposed to these kinds of things in the past. So that's important, knowing the voter history. I think the other thing that is new now is with Michigan's new No Reason Absentee program. That was a big, big surprise and something that we saw, especially in this most recent May election. Mm-hmm. The number of absentee voters outnumbered the number of day of voters, which that's not the way it usually works. Usually, the day of voters will outnumber those who vote absentee. But in this case, ballots or applications were sent out. People requested them. Ballots went out. And the people who voted weeks ahead outnumbered those who voted the day of. And so knowing that calendar becomes very, very important for how you roll out your messaging. Because if you understand that a lot of the people in our community are going to start voting 6 weeks before Election Day, you can't wait until 2 weeks before to start talking. You need to be talking about these things and according to the calendar of when ballots start going out. And I think, you know, most communities will do this. You know, you can track and you can get from your city clerk or your county clerk who has a ballot, who has applied for a ballot. Do they have a ballot and has that ballot come back in yet? You obviously don't know how that person has voted, but you know that, okay, you know, Martha and Stan have two ballots sitting on their kitchen table. They've had them for a week and they haven't returned them yet. So maybe we should, you know, we can send them a mail piece, or maybe we can get them a phone call, or maybe one of our volunteers can knock on their door and answer a question. And then, you know, okay, they've sent their ballot back in. No reason why we save some money. We don't need to send them another mail piece, or we don't need to make a phone call to them. We can make sure we're making good use of the resources, the limited resources that you're going to have. So I think communities are going to need to do a special, and it's going to be it's an evolving thing. We're all learning with this new process, but I think the AV is going to be a game changer in a lot of these communities going forward.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that from your perspective. How do you see that changing the way we vote and the way that these ballot proposals go in the future? Do you think that this is going to be, obviously, as we saw recently, that it was a larger impact with more absentee voters than in-person voters? But what do you think that's going to mean moving forward, both, you know, just politically in general, but specific to some of these ballot proposals that might be happening at the local level?
Well, I think the conventional wisdom was always that, you know, the people who were on the permanent AV list were mostly senior citizens. Mm-hmm. And so the conventional wisdom and the track record was, okay, so they're older voters. They're probably a little more stingy with their money. They're probably a little more prone to be opposed to tax increases. Maybe a little less open to change, kind of thing. All these kind of stereotypes you put on voting blocks. I think that absentee voter pool is going to become much more diverse. It is going to much more reflect the typical day of voting group, where anybody could show up, and you'll probably have some diehard seniors who love to go and get their sticker and vote on the day, and younger moms, families. You're going to start to see that happen. I have never voted absentee in my life, with the exception of the 1 year I worked on a campaign and had to be out of town the day that we were voting. I have always gone to vote at my precinct, and just last week I sent in an application for a permanent AV ballot. Because I didn't know where I was going to be, but I signed up and now I'm going to get one. And that's not something I ever did before. And so you've taken me out of that day of voting pool and put me into that absentee voting pool. And so I think people are going to need to think about the fact that we're not just talking to the senior citizens anymore when we're talking absentee voting. We're talking to a much wider and more diverse group of voters. And so the messaging needs to be reflect that. And I think the research needs to do a better job of doing, understanding what the feelings of your electorate are in a community and be able to direct that accordingly.
So messaging, critically important, but as we know, there's a very fine line between education and advocacy. Mm-hmm. And for our members, for those working in local government, that's something that we're always concerned about. So what suggestions do you have for communities who are looking to tackle this, who might not be able to cross that advocacy line and who are very, very wary of that?
Get a lawyer. would be my advice, because it is a very hard line. And even when people are saying I'm doing it on my lunch hour, or I'm not advocating, I'm educating, a campaign can be, killed, especially in this social media age, with one misstep or one mistake. And you want to, it's again, a lot of this stuff requires resources, but legal resources are very important. And I would not skimp on the advice that you're going to get from a counsel, an election lawyer. And I would, someone who knows these rules, not someone who, maybe a municipal lawyer or someone who has other areas of expertise, but someone who really understands what you can say, where you can say it, and when you can say it, and who can say it. Because you don't want your effort to be derailed because of a simple mistake, or someone saying something at the wrong place, or the wrong disclaimer being put on a piece of mail, those kinds of things. I think it's very important to get legal counsel and have that kind of chart your path. And I think you need to be very aggressive in setting that tone with all of the people working on your effort. They have to understand that you're going to take that seriously, and it's not something to just be, roll your eyes at and whatever. It has to be a kind of a tone set amongst everyone, and everyone has to kind of follow it carefully, because again, you could put all kinds of time and resources into it, and one person says the wrong thing at the wrong time, someone decides to tweet that or make that go viral, and you've sunk your effort.
Sure. So let's talk about social media, because obviously it's huge. It's a topic of conversation at all levels of politics. But specific to this, so what are you seeing as you're working with this contact with voters via social media? And knowing local governments, some of them are active on social media, some of them aren't as active on social media. Should they be thinking about social media? And what are some strategies there that they might want to think about as they're moving forward?
I think that it has to be a part of your campaign. And I think you have to understand going in that a good portion of people on social media are grumpy about most things. And that you are going to see, especially once you start talking about, we're going to do an income tax or a millage or something, this, that, or the other, you're going to get a lot of people who are going to say, stick it, and be very vocal about it. I think you need to be disciplined in understanding that that's not who your audience is, and that it can be incredibly effective in getting out salient facts about what you're asking to an audience of people who really want to know and want to be educated. I think most people are probably somewhere in the middle of those who will just, support anything and those who are going to oppose anything. And most of those people want to know what it is they're being asked to vote on, what it's going to go for, and if it's really going to do what you say it's going to do. And so social media gives everybody a very cost-effective way of communicating facts to people. I think you need to have someone dedicated to managing that and making sure that that when someone says something negative or when someone asks a question, that those questions are answered in a very straightforward and a easygoing, non-confrontational way. I think that if there's someone who's consistently being a jerk, then you kind of look for the time to send them on their way. But it's going to be very frustrating for a voter to see something on a social media page, to ask a question, an honest question, and then have it go unresponded to, when really they could be a potential yes vote. They just have a simple question about something, or maybe they're reluctant. Yes. But if you can just give me some assurance, and if the campaign or the effort behind it kind of writes that off or thinks I'm not going to respond, you're giving away potential votes. And so I would say, be very upfront, be very straightforward and honest in response, be very responsive, don't let things go for a long time without responding. But especially when resources are very slim for these kinds of things, you don't have tons of money. If you had tons of money, you wouldn't be asking for money. if you had tons of money to do this, social media, Facebook, Twitter, those kinds of things allow you to reach large groups of people inexpensively.
So in terms of engagement with voters, would you say that social media is the most important piece of it? And if it's not social media, if social media is just a part of that, what is the most important way to engage with voters?
I think that it needs to be, you need to look at all of the ways that you typically would. I think traditional media and PR continues to be a big part of it because, you know, we talked about older voters, and while Facebook is the demographic of Facebook is getting older, there is still a large group of very, very loyal regular voters who probably aren't on Facebook, but who read the paper or who may listen to the morning radio show. So don't discount meeting with, you know, local reporters and keeping them up to date on what's going on. You don't want to make an enemy, if you can, of those reporters and the editorial boards. I think in most cases, I think they'd probably be fairly sympathetic to the argument. And so you want to get with them early, too, just like you do the other members of the coalition. Give them the facts early so that they don't hear something from somebody they shouldn't and make a wrong assumption and start to print something that then you have to try to correct that's out there. I think looking at local radio shows is always important, you know, and then the other, you know, the tried and true things. I think, you know, I wouldn't necessarily recommend billboards, but, you know, mail pieces continue to be effective. Robocalls and phone calls are dicey because no one answers their phone anymore. Mm-hmm. You can't really send them to cell phones. And so, you know, We used the phone calls in a very targeted way. When we knew we had a group of people, we had their phone numbers, and we knew that they were part of our, they were supporters of ours, and we just wanted to remind them to go vote. So I think you have to look at the entire, you know, the entire toolbox of things, because there's not, you're probably not going to have the money to do TV ads, would be my guess. And so, or even necessarily radio ads. You might have enough to do, you know, a print ad in the Sunday paper before the election, but, you know, that's probably too late. So I think you want to look at all of the things that you have available to you, both from an earned media standpoint, from social media, from mail, and then, you know, kind of just direct voter-to-voter contact. You know, other thing, too, is to look for public forums where people are arriving and are going to places to find information. And, you know, one thing that the Lansing schools did a good job of doing is going to every neighborhood meeting in the 3 months before the election, sending someone from the committee and someone from the district who could go. And, you know, if someone had an official question, there was someone there to answer it. If there was someone from the committee who more of an electioneering question, you know, from a vote yes kind of perspective, then there was someone from the committee who could answer that question. But, you know, they went to dozens of these neighborhood meetings and with their little presentation and answered questions and took the lumps when they came, but then also found that, you know, there are neighborhoods, this neighborhood's with us and these folks are with us.
So you talked about a toolbox, mm-hmm. lots of tools in the toolbox. You know, you have a podcast. I have a podcast here at the League. Is that something that you're seeing that's becoming more of an influencing tool? I'm always curious to know, you know, sort of we've been growing these on the League side, and this has been an interesting avenue to get information to our members who, you know, might prefer to get 15, 20 minutes on their way to work in the car when they have a moment. I certainly love to do that. But are you seeing this as an influencing tool in politics, or do you think something that I've been seeing as of late, everybody has a podcast now. Everybody's talking about something. So is there too much of that? Or is this actually a way, an avenue where we can actually influence politics?
I think it is. And I think and I'm new to this too. So we're kind of learning all this together. But what I have kind of come to believe is that you know, none of us are Conan O'Brien who can just, you know,
we like to pretend we can, yes,
but, you know, we just can't start talking for an hour and have a million people listen to us. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have an audience, and just like any part of communications, you have to know who that audience is. And so there are people, you know, like my mom and dad who listen to my podcast all the time.
Yeah. Hi, but, mom and dad.
Right.
We
exactly.
can say that now,
but it's a challenge to identify that. So one way to kind of find those audiences is by talking to people who are influencers who bring an audience with them. Because a podcast is starting from scratch. You're starting mm-hmm. from, you know, it's like a Twitter account. You start with zero. You need to build up that audience. And a podcast is very similar. But if you invite someone to talk about this topic, or you go on a podcast that already has an audience or has a following, then that person's influence and the people who listen to them or care about them start to listen to yours. And I think that I wouldn't necessarily recommend, unless you have a local podcast in your community that everyone listens to, as an end all be all. But there may be some that have little pockets of audiences throughout your community that, you know, I just throw in some, maybe a city council person has one that's been, you know, going for he or she's been working on it for a couple of years and has a pretty decent following. Well, then you're not talking to your whole city by going on that podcast, but you're talking to the couple hundred, 300 people who may then talk to their friends. So I would include it a lot like you would look at all earned media mm-hmm. and media assets. You know, you want to see, okay, who's on our editorial board, who are the local radio show hosts, who are the reporters we have to keep in mind. And hey, anybody around here have a podcast that we could go on, or is there an audience that we could reach through a podcast that we do?
Sure. Well, interesting. It's an interesting topic as we start to think about different ways that we can influence people, different ways we can communicate with people in messaging. Social media is a big one, but I get a lot of news and information from podcasts. I'm sure some of our members prefer this mm-hmm. to other avenues of communication that we send to them. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on if this is something that maybe locals could use in getting some of their messaging out.
Well, and not to interrupt, because I know you told me before, don't interrupt.
Well, I said that. Let's just be clear so everybody knows. I said that because
your producer doesn't like
it. Yes, a producer doesn't like it. We like to speak, you know, sort of in terms so that, you know, it's easy to hear both of us. So, right. I mean, you can interrupt, okay. But...
but, no, well, we talked about the senior voting population sure. at the beginning. You know, there are certain things that ways that we can reach a senior population. And there's a lot of frustration, especially amongst pollsters now, that young people don't answer their phones and you can't poll effectively through cell phones. So what is a way that young people are getting information? And a podcast is one. So, you know, you may want to look at, you know, as your messaging goes, okay, how do we, as our audiences are kind of bifurcated, okay, we can do this to reach these audiences, but we know we've got these neighborhoods in this community that are a lot of young people, young families, young single people, young working people. How do we reach them? And I think you're right. The podcast is, a lot of people are listening to that. You kind of at this point, it's a little bit as social media kind of was developed. You either had people who were into it or like, nah. And I think it's similar with podcasts. You've got people who are like, I just can't listen to those things. And you got some people who listen to them nonstop. And so, you know, I think you need to make sure that that's a part of the toolbox for sure.
Sure. Sure. I totally understand that. And I agree. It's something that is an interesting tool. So you spoke about young people. And we think about, you know, voter turnout as it comes to some of these elections. You know, local elections don't seem quite as exciting as maybe some of our federal elections. So what suggestions do you have outside of targeting the different groups and outside of maybe thinking about podcasts as an option in that? What suggestions or tools would you recommend to local governments who are maybe looking to target young people in particular? Because they seem to be a tricky group in trying to get them to show up at the polls.
It's a tough question. And I think that a lot of it goes to kind of what it is that you are, you know, what's on the ballot. What is it you're asking them to do? I mean, I think in a lot of cases and in working with the MML in the past, you know, a lot of the investments and things that communities are looking to make with increased revenue are services and amenities that attract that kind of that population, the kind of the placemaking kind of thing that MML and communities have been talking about. And I think you want to try to sell those and make those selling points that might not appeal to the older voter, you know, who might not be looking for those kinds of things and those kinds of amenities, but it will for those younger voters. And I think it goes back to the coalition that you build. I think it's very challenging for any group of people to kind of sit in a room and figure out, okay, here, we've got it all figured out. These are the messages and this is how we're going to tell it. Build a committee. And as important as, you know, the chamber president is, or the big employer, or the, you know, the school district or the police chief is to your effort, they're young business owners, they're young professionals, there are young professional groups and organizations in your communities, and tap into those groups and ask them to be a part of the effort. I think that in most cases, they're going to be a sympathetic audience and a supportive audience. And so find those young leaders who are working in your community and ask them to be a part of this effort. I think a lot of people talk about the millennial generation as one that wants a cause, wants to feel like they're involved and they're making a difference.
Right.
And they want meaning in their work. And give them something to do. You know, if they're looking for something to do, maybe this is the cause. Maybe this is the thing that they can do to help their community, is being part of this, being a part of a ballot proposal. One of these things, maybe be a part of the committee, maybe be someone who then goes and holds meetings and talks to their peers. I would say that they're an engaged group of people who are looking for something to dedicate their time to. And I think that in a lot of communities like this that have populations of young people, that you should tap into them and not just assume or not think that we can figure out what they want. Go ask them what they want and how the messages resonate with them. I think you'll learn a lot from that, and it will help the campaign overall.
Absolutely. And I like that perspective in terms of, you know, what we think about millennials, and being a millennial myself, sometimes what the assumption is fits and sometimes it doesn't feel like it fits for us. So actually asking people, you know, what motivates them, what they do want, I think is incredibly helpful for something of this nature.
I was in a meeting recently where a bunch of old people, and I was in the meeting, so I will classify myself as an old person, as not being a millennial. But at one point I finally said, and the whole purpose, the purpose of the meeting was trying to figure out, how do we make ourselves more attractive to this demographic? And I'm like, you know, the longer we talk about what we think they think is cool, the less cool it becomes. So why don't we stop this? Why don't we talk to people who actually are of that age group and ask them what they think, as opposed to for us trying to figure out what they think is cool?
Yeah, that seems incredibly helpful. I would prefer to be asked what I think is cool than for someone to assume what I think is cool. And I think that goes for any age group, whether you're a millennial or not. It's more helpful to actually ask and have that conversation. And along the way, you're building those relationships. An open conversation is incredibly helpful. So I love that perspective. It's very interesting. And it is interesting being on the other side of it and hearing about meetings like this where we're being discussed, but we don't have a seat at the table. And I think from a millennial perspective, we would love a seat at the table. We'd love to talk about it. And if you ask us, we're happy to do it.
As a generation, you have a lot of people out there scratching their heads, just trying to figure out how do we reach them?
Call me. Well, I know people. I'm happy. Call me. I'll talk. I'm sure I can give my opinion and my thoughts on a lot of different things, which is maybe why I have this podcast.
There you go.
But I do want to sort of ask you a little bit more about what you've seen and your experience in the past with some of these proposals. What I specifically would like to know is, what do you see some of these campaigns doing wrong?
When they take voters for granted, that is, and I will put on my chamber hat, my Lansing chamber hat on this one, is that when communities have just assumed, they've always voted for this in the past, they'll vote for it again. We're going to put it on at the last minute. We're not going to tell people what it is. We're going to give everybody 2 months to vote on it before the election is. That's what gets people annoyed, because, and I'm not even necessarily sure from a voter perspective, because if you're inclined to vote for it, you're going to vote for it. But for the people who are, like, if you're going to ask for the endorsement of organizations to support this, if you're not going to be upfront about what it is, and give people time and be willing to come in and talk about what it is that you're asking for, that really leaves a bad taste in the mouth of organizations in a community that want to be a part of what's going on. And, you know, in a lot of times, local governments are not shy about coming to ask for favors and ask for help for things. But then when it comes to this, you know, we're just going to put it on the ballot and, you know, just go with it. I've seen locally two very different approaches like that. This Lansing School District was very open, very transparent about what they were asking for and how it was going to be spent. And we've seen on a county level very much the opposite, that the commission puts something up and there's very little conversation. No one really knows. And when we ask questions, it's, you know, don't bother us with questions. We're just going to do this because we know we can, and Ingham County likes tax increases. So we're fine. And I think that in certain places, very few places, you can get away with that. I mean, I remember when I talked to a business owner here downtown in Lansing when the Lansing millage was up, and he wasn't a Lansing voter. He lived in Eaton County, I think. And their community had turned down every millage increase in the last 75 years. And there was like, they were asking for like a quarter of a mil for something, and it got destroyed. Mm-hmm. And he just kind of shook his head at places that are very open to increasing revenue. Like, that's not where we are. So I think, especially if you're not in a place where voters have a long track record of being very open to revenue, it's incredibly important that you don't take those things for granted, or that you approach things in a very open and transparent way. That has been that, and I think either not doing research or ignoring the research is a good way to lose.
Sure. So I just have to ask, because this has nothing to do with local ballot proposals, but do you think ignoring the research, taking voters for granted, do you think that's something that played into the 2016 elections? And do you think that that's changing as we're approaching, you know, sort of the 2020 elections?
On a federal level, you mean?
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to get political here, but I definitely think that the Clinton campaign took people for granted. I think that they thought they had this sewn up. I thought they had it sewn up. I think everyone thought they had it sewn up. That's why the reaction the day after was as dramatic as it was.
Sure.
And why resources weren't put in places, because they thought, man, we've got Michigan in the bag. We're up 12, 15 points. There's no way we're going to lose this. And I think that was more a case of taking people for granted along the way, and maybe not reading the tea leaves correctly as they saw what was going on.
So were they not reading that research? Were they not actually doing that polling that led to that? It is a little more political, and we are getting more at a federal level, but I think that's an important connection to make, that it is, you know, some of this polling information and some of this research is so critical to knowing, you know, sort of how you need to message and what you need to be doing and how you're going to run, you know, a campaign, whether you're running for president or whether you're running, you know, a local ballot proposal.
Well, I think that if I'm remembering right, the polling at the end was showing that Trump was gaining. Mm-hmm. I just think, and I think a lot of people just thought, this guy can't be president, right? I mean, the politics aside, he just was not the kind of person who you looked at and as a Hillary Clinton supporter, or even myself as a Republican, longtime Republican, think he's just not going to do it.
Sure.
And, you know, polling has become, while it's still important, less predictable because of, you know, cell phones and because of the shift in how we can reach people. I just think that there was the data, there are people who kind of looked at the data and believed it, and then there are the people who were just kind of doing the eye test and like, nah, it's just, I'm looking at this and I can't see her and I can't see him and I can't see her losing to him. And so that was kind of where the numbers and the science were not matching up with what people's kind of emotions and what the eye test was telling them. And I think they went with their eyes and their gut as opposed to the numbers.
Sure. But I think there's definitely a comparison here to be drawn to that local level, in the sense of, you know, as you said, you can't take voters for granted, and you have to be listening at all times and paying attention and doing the work, because not everything is just in the bag and you can't treat it as such.
Right.
So I thought that was some interesting tidbits of information you provided on that. So when it comes to local ballot proposals, and thanks for letting me sort of interrupt our local ballot proposal topic with some comparisons we could draw to what we've seen in the past and what we might see in the future on a federal level, just because it's interesting to me. And I think there are some comparisons to be drawn. But, you know, when we're getting back to local ballot proposals, as we've talked about, don't take the voters for granted. Don't take the research for granted. Make sure you're paying attention to that. Is there anything else that local communities, local governments, as they're looking to do these, should definitely not be doing?
I guess I think, and this is more of a long term don't do than maybe a short term thing. Mm-hmm. I don't cry wolf. Don't put forward something that you say solves the problems, and then 2 years or 3 years come back and say, yeah, problem's not solved, we need to do it again. Mm-hmm. Because voters are savvy, and I think they're willing in many communities to give you the benefit of the doubt and do what it needs to be done to pass something or to fix a problem. But they want to know what's been fixed. I'm like, okay, you've come to us, we've given you this, now fix it. I think the problems come when either it doesn't get fixed or someone wasn't honest with voters in the first place in what the solution actually did. Or they just got greedy and came back and just wanted to do another one. Mm-hmm. So be strategic in this, and because voter fatigue really did play. And I can say, in the Lansing experience with the school district, you know, it was 3 years ago that they did, the large, bonding proposal for the three school buildings. And that was a huge transformation for the whole district. That was not just about buildings. That was transforming the entire way that the district was going to approach their educational approach. But the first thing that we heard when we started talking to people this last spring was, didn't you just do this? And even though it was very different, and a sinking fund was for hard fixes like new doors and new windows and security cameras and things like that, and it wasn't about the broader bond proposal, voters don't necessarily differentiate those things. They just mm-hmm. know that you asked 3 years ago and you said it was all going to be fine, and now 3 years later you're asking again. So I think that, again, this goes back to what you're talking about taking people for granted. I think have a long-term strategic plan about how you're going to go about these things, because they're not easy, and they're not cheap, and they take a lot of time. So you don't want to do them every 3 years. You don't want to keep doing them all the time. Figure out what you want to ask for and then deliver on it. And then when people can see that, okay, we did it, and they delivered on what they said they were going to do, we can trust them. I think that is the biggest, no-go, is to continue to not deliver on what it is that people think they're voting for.
Sure. So do you have advice then for communities who maybe have passed a proposal, a few years ago for something specific, and a few years later, there's another proposal that's coming onto the ballot that is not related to that, but as you said, voter fatigue. What suggestions do you have for a separate issue that's not tied to the first proposal that, you might have some challenges in encountering voters, really?
I mean, I think the research will guide you, but my gut is to thank people and to say, 3 years ago, you stood with us. We did this important work and we got this done. And our community is changing, it's growing, it's doing this, that, and the other. We have additional needs. We're asking that you stand with us again. And something else has popped up, something new is here. We have this new challenge or something along those lines. But tie back to the fact that voters supported you once before, and this, you're coming back and you're asking them to support you once again. And not try to hide from the fact that, try to create in your messaging a pattern of local support for the things in the community. And we were able, we did that a lot with the schools. Like, you have been with the Lansing schools for a long time, voters. You have supported us from the beginning. You've supported us here. You support us there. Now we have boilers that don't work. We have school buildings that aren't secure. This is the next step. So help us take that next step. So to appeal to that sense of, I've done this before and we're making progress together, would be the way I would suggest you do it.
So would you say that's your biggest piece of advice then for communities who have seen a proposal fail and are considering kind of getting back into that campaign again? And if that's not your biggest piece of advice, what would be?
I think that if you're going to get back into it, I don't think you should be afraid to admit what went wrong or to apologize if something didn't. If voters didn't approve something, acknowledge that. And if you're going to go and try to do it again, acknowledge why they may not have and kind of address and acknowledge, okay, yeah, you guys had doubts on this. Maybe we didn't do a good enough job explaining what this is all for. We want to come back and do this the right way. And we're going to be upfront, or we're going to give you more details or answer more questions. Again, I think we saw that. I think that when voters, because in most of these cases, these probably aren't going to be happening in November. I mean, they're going to be happening in off main election time. So your voting mm-hmm. population is going to be smaller. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a better ability to talk to a lot of those diehard voters, and you're going to know who that smaller population is. And I think you can, as long as you are upfront with them and give them the facts, I think that they're a very educated group of people. They're the diehards. And they want to know that someone's not trying to pull something over on them.
Sure.
And so I think that you just approach them in a very straightforward and honest way.
Absolutely. Well, Matt, thank you so much. Before we end today, anything else you'd like to add as far as ballot proposals go? And obviously, before we leave, I would love to hear, and our members would love to hear more about your podcast and where they can find you.
Well, thanks. I don't have anything more on ballot proposals. You kind of tapped me out on my knowledge on that topic, but it's been fun talking to you. Yeah. So, the Cold Oatmeal Podcast is the name of our podcast. There are six of us at Rest Strategies, and about 2 years ago now, we just finished our second season, and it was in the summer 2 years ago that we started realizing how much we liked just talking with each other. And so we decided to put this together and bought some microphones, and we learned how to do it. I got Joe on my team, has turned himself into a little producer and has gotten really quite good at that, and it becomes his favorite thing to do. And so every couple weeks, it comes out every Thursday afternoon at 1:30, and we try to, we say it's about public relations, but I think of the 40 episodes we've done, maybe two have been on PR. We like to bring in lots of fun people to talk to, reporters, some capital types, but also people who have nothing to do with Lansing. Those are some of our most favorite ones.
Interesting. And so where can our members find that podcast if they're looking for it?
Well, Cold Oatmeal, you can find it on Apple Podcasts. It's on also our website, reshstrategies.com. You can find there at the Cold Oatmeal tab. We're taking a brief summer vacation, but we'll come back in September with our third episode, or our third season.
Excellent. And how can people get a hold of you if they'd like to chat more with you about what you do or what we talked about today?
Yeah, we're going to reststrategies.com is the website. You can find me there. You can find all the people who I work with. You can email me from there, or our phone number's there too. So happy to talk anytime.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Matt. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks so much.
This has been a production of the Michigan Municipal League. For more information on our programs and services, please visit www.mml.org and join us for the next episode of We Love Where You Live.